This is an RNZ podcast.
This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. This week, New Zealand's back in the top 10 for world press freedom, which is obviously good news. But after the Christchurch atrocity that the media called the end of our innocence, our media now need to be vigilant about their freedom too. Also, National served up the slushies in jail story to the media, who then forced it down our throats for 2 days, and then they bit the hand that spoon-fed them the whole sorry saga in the first place. But first, for years, the country's biggest selling paper has talked about making online readers pay for its best journalism, just like the subscribers of its printed paper do. And this week, the Herald finally put a price on it. But will people used to paying nothing now cough up to cover the cost of quality reporting?
It's a big day at NZME today with the launch of New Zealand Herald Premium. As you may have noticed, if you've been on the website today or any papers affiliated with the New Zealand Herald, there are some articles you can't read unless you've paid for your subscription. It's being hailed as a success for quality journalism in New Zealand.
That was Mike Yardley on News Talk ZB on Tuesday afternoon with some big in-house news, the arrival of digital subscriptions for its sister outlet, the New Zealand Herald, and other regional North Island newspapers owned by the same publisher, NZME. Now, this means the free ride is over for people who have been getting the best and costliest of the company's journalism for nothing online for years. They now have to pay for the best bits, just like the 200,000-odd people and businesses who pay for a copy of the printed paper. Now, the Herald isn't the first publisher here to ask online readers to fork out. The NBR, Ashburton Guardian and Gisborne Herald have already put up their own local paywalls. But the Herald's move is the biggest one so far, by far. And the stakes are pretty big too, and not just for the Herald, as we'll hear. On News Talk ZB last Tuesday, Mike Yardley turned to the Herald's managing editor, Shane Curry.
G'day, Shane. Who drove this project? Was this you, Mr. Curry?
No, Mariana is front and centre. So Mariana came back from Wilson and Cambridge University last year looking for a new challenge, and we certainly had one for her.
Yeah.
Probably 20 years too late in many respects.
Now there, Shane Curry was talking about Mariana Alexander, the Herald's premium content editor, who we heard from briefly on Media Watch last weekend. And later, we'll hear more from her about what she learned overseas about paying for news. And as you heard there, Herald boss Shane Curry said he reckoned they were now bringing in online subscriptions about 20 years too late. At a journalism conference 2 years ago, Shane Curry said the same thing, though he reckoned then it was probably too late to change that.
We as an industry made some big errors 20 years ago when our websites did come live, and that we put all of that journalism and content up for free. People are used to that now, and there's no going back on that in my view.
But the Herald's publishers have been talking about putting up a paywall since 2011, and they'd always shied away from doing it. However, last year, Jane Hastings' successor Michael Boggs finally confirmed the change was imminent.
And we're introducing what you'd call a freemium model. Now, I'm sure there is lots of content on the New Zealand Herald site that people would not be prepared to pay for. So the good news is between 80 and 90% of our content will still be free. It's only 10, 15, 20% of our content.
And last Tuesday, yellow premium content tags appeared on links to stories on the Herald's website, mostly ones by their senior reporters and columnists. On Tuesday, for example, those included a deep dive into 10 years of local companies' share prices to reveal which ones had most richly rewarded their shareholders over the years. There was a ranking of the governing coalition's ministers and a scoop about a diplomat caught out at customs holding $300,000 in cash. Shane Curry boasted, there's plenty more where that came from for our premium subscribers. And later in the day, there was a fresh story billed as the biggest rugby story of the week, one promising to reveal the staggering amount of meth that Kiwis take every day, and another about the tantalising prospect for motorists up north of 200 kilometres of motorway through Auckland from Warkworth to Cambridge. Now, elsewhere on the homepage, there were the kind of stories that you don't need to pay to read. The biggest loser from the rift between Princes William and Harry, for instance, and another one headlined, I Trust Judith, says Simon Bridges. Now, back in February, the NZME chief executive Michael Boggs said that the very future of the Herald's journalism depended on this paywall.
The paywall component, which we really call as the future of news and journalism in New Zealand, it's actually monetising that content that we're actually giving away for free today. And, you know, people are more and more prepared to pay for things that they trust and want information on.
And Michael Boggs repeated that last Tuesday when that premium content paywall went up. So, with a lot riding on this, at the Herald and elsewhere, what are the chances of success and the consequences of failure? Later, we'll hear from an expert on how paywalls have worked around the world and how they haven't, and an expert in getting New Zealanders to pay for online journalism. But first, Mirjana Alexander, the premium content editor at the Herald and the driving force for the launch of those online subscriptions.
We have to produce the journalism that our audience values, and the thing that's really great about that is it turns out to be the stuff that takes a bit of time and takes a bit of investigative work, and that's our unique content, and that's what we're putting, I guess, a lot more focus on, because yes, up until now, I guess we've been in the race with everyone to get mass eyeballs on our site, but I think anyone with half an eyeball on the industry knows that actually the economics of media have been eroded, and we'll never be bigger than Facebook and Google, and so therefore, we won't attract the digital advertising dollars that they do.
It's pretty clear that a key distinction is if there's a senior journalist, experienced journalist working on it, that will be something you now have to pay for. Say if there's a story about, for example, Sir Peter Jackson or some of a bit of a name, but it will get a lot of clicks if you throw it on the main site, that you don't have like someone overruling a premium editor like yourself say, actually, no, don't put the tag on this because we'll get lots of income if you throw that on the main site.
No, not at all. No one's fighting in the newsroom about what should be on our free site and what should be part of the digital subscriptions. Yes, we do have two jobs to do. We've again made that pretty clear, and that the majority of the content on our site remains free.
Tim Murphy, your former colleague and former editor at the Herald, was asking, what guarantee is there that the money that subscribers are paying, sort of $200 a year, depending on their deal, will actually go to supporting journalism and not dividends for the shareholders and the investors, or you know, paying off debt or anything like that?
Look, we've been pretty clear that this is definitely about journalism, and the beauty, I guess, of me running this project is spending a bit more time with our CEO, Michael Boggs, who's utterly behind journalism. And in fact, just this morning we were having a conversation about, I was saying to him, I think we should get cracking on employing a few more journalists with this money that's coming in the door. So,
and what did he say?
He nodded his head and we started talking about some names. So there you go. That's how much how interested he is in that. And don't you worry, I'm here to say, well, I won't be letting him forget that.
Mm. One thing, though, that is a bit different is that the Herald site also has to be something of a vehicle for your sister station News Talk ZB, which is part of NZME, a media company that owns the both of you. There are radio hosts that have opinion columns on there that aren't behind the paywall. That's part of the exposure for them. One media executive described the kind of opinionated and political stuff they write as he described it as a virus that could affect the Herald's brand for quality news.
When I was the Weekends editor, I had the pleasure of having Kerry McIver write a weekly column and Heather Duplessy-Allen. So as it so happens, they are, of course, also News Talk ZB hosts, but I commissioned columns from them because they have a range of views, like a range of the columnists on our site, and our audience is interested in them. And we've got data to show us exactly how these stories are working and what's rating. And so it'll be a very clear sign about the audience value. But look, let's be clear, the New Zealand Herald website doesn't exist as a promotional outlet for News Talk ZB. It exists to do great journalism for our readers, and that's what we're really focused on.
But if we looked, say, at the weekend before the premium banner went up, Leighton Smith has a Weekend Herald column now printed in the paper and online. That was leading the world section, War on Christianity. I mean, a very personal, idiosyncratic piece. Kind of confusing, hard to understand, but really a politics that a lot of people wouldn't share. People were even emailing us about it at MediaWatch saying the Herald wants us to pay for this.
It's actually, that's not the only, they're not the only columnists though we have. We have such a range and depth of columns across the 7 days that are published online and in the paper. And look, one of our lovely lines that I like in our brand campaign is we don't agree with everything we print, but we print a range of perspectives.
And none of your audience research said, well, I would withhold paying for the Herald online because I read so much stuff from opinionated radio hosts whose politics I don't agree with?
No, not at all. And in fact, I was really thrilled about the research that we started for our journalism, and it was really heartening. And we didn't get any feedback about particular people saying, yes, no, we don't want to read them, or we do want to read them. I think that's probably the space of the Twitter sphere where the people get a bit obsessed about that. But that's often, as we all know, not a reflection of real life.
But it's not just the Twitter sphere, though, is it? I mean, for example, where you have the Herald online before the premium era, publishing several columns by, for example, Mike Hosking of News Talk ZB, virulently opposed to cycleways. Several times he wrote about this. Then you have Simon Wilson, a writer that has been promoted as premium content, directly rebutting him, throwing in a whole
Isn't
lot of facts.
Isn't that good? Isn't that really nice, Colin? That's exactly what I was just referring to about a range of views. So we're not pushing or promoting one view. We are letting all views breathe, and that's how it should be. We are so not an organ of record. I don't think it's our job to be. It's no longer the media's role to be an organ of record. Yes, we should report the news, and we should bring some clarity to that. And it's also our job, though, to present a range of views. I think you are aware that when I studied at Cambridge University last year, my topic was fake news, and I became really interested in the spread of misinformation and the platforms allowing that to happen.
When you were overseas with that opportunity to look at how other news organisations are doing this, putting up paywalls or trying to get revenue from their readers one way or another, what was it you saw that interested you there?
I went to the Financial Times, the Telegraph, the Times of London, the Guardian, and they were all incredibly generous in sharing with me their reader revenue models because, as you'll know, they all have a range from hard paywalls to the freemium models to the membership models of the Guardian. And I guess something we all hope to be true and believe to be true, but they were proving it, which is that people are prepared to pay for quality journalism. So I really... The Guardian this week's announced an incredible financial turnaround, and it's down to their subscriptions, largely driven by their digital revenues. So it's incredible, I think, for the industry that reader revenue in many of the big global publishers is now outstripping commercial revenue. It's not necessarily great, because obviously the commercial revenue is vital, but it's really heartening to show that there are global trends for some years now that show that audiences are prepared to pay for quality journalism.
Yeah, I guess in the case of the Guardian, it's tricky, isn't it? Because for years they were burning up money provided by that non-profit trust runs the whole thing and made it possible, I guess, for them to get to this point. But it's that willingness to pay, isn't it?
That's right. And it's not to be sneezed at, the Guardian. You know, it was a £57 million loss 3 years ago, and this week it's an £800,000 profit. So, look, it's a hard road, and we all know that. We all of us in this industry know that it's a model under pressure. So it's fabulous to be able to do something that does support journalism.
Are you aware that there are some people who have been fiddling with the code and basically saying they can do workarounds for the paywall and criticising NZME for having a system that's hackable?
I have seen some of that on social media, but I've also seen the really nice stuff that says, well, why would you steal people's work like this? And also, why would you take the risk of introducing code, you're not your own code, and to see what that might do to your computer? But look, we're not alone in this space, and it's happened. It's the case for other publishers. So we're very much aware of it, and having a look at it, we know that that's being talked about out there. But as I say, it's also quite heartening to see the people saying this is not on and not that fair, is it?
That was Mirjana Alexander, the premium content editor at the New Zealand Herald and the driving force behind this week's launch of online subscriptions after years and years of planning for them. So will online Herald readers cough up and fill the Herald's coffers with funds for quality journalism? I asked Dr. Maria Mililati, the co-director of the AUT's Centre for Journalism, Media and Democracy, whose research what kind of content works behind paywalls around the world and how media companies can attract and retain subscribers. And I also spoke to Alex Clark, the chief executive and founder of Press Patron, an online platform that's been connecting outlets offering public interest journalism with New Zealand readers willing to pay for it since 2017.
We found that it was quite surprising. There were more people within the survey willing to make a voluntary contribution to support quality journalism than people that were willing to pay for journalism that was locked up behind a paywall. And since we've launched, we've found that for our successful publishers, they are converting between 1% and 5% of their monthly unique audience. And I think the Herald is doing a good job of focusing it on premium investigative journalism. What I think's interesting, though, is that they may have had quite a bit of success if they'd just asked without putting up the barriers. Mm. So you've got Kirsty Johnston, you've got Matt Nippert, you've got Keith Eng, a whole range of really high-quality journalists that produce absolutely fantastic work. And I think there would have been a proportion of readers out there willing to make a contribution without having the restrictions in place.
Yeah, so that's a little similar to, say, the Guardian newspaper that Mirjana Alexander talked about.
And then the other thing that we found when we were doing the open-ended feedback is that a lot of people articulated in their own words, I'm willing to pay to support these investigative, in-depth pieces of journalism. I think journalism's important for democracy, but I absolutely hate the idea of it being locked up and restricted for myself or also for other people that can't afford it. Hopefully the Herald gets a lot of people paying because it is important to get this paid for, But there is the risk of that antagonistic relationship with their readers, where it gets people's backs up rather than a collaborative partnership, which happens under a voluntary model. In terms of the payment averages that we've found, we've been launched for 2 years now. So half of people opt into monthly contributions and the other half opt into one-time contributions. For the recurring contributions, the average is $11.40 per month. Quite a lot of money over the lifetime of those users. And on top of that, the one-time contribution average is $49. 44% are giving $50 or higher, and 14% give $100 or higher for the one-time contributions.
Okay.
Now, in the context of the Herald, they're charging $20 per month. We've found there are a lot of readers willing to contribute much more. And on top of that, there are people willing to contribute less. So Mariana said they're interested in experimenting and trying different models. I think it'd be an interesting one to explore.
Well, Maria, are there examples overseas which you think are useful comparisons to the Herald?
Yeah, there are quite a few papers. We have a quite similar model. For example, Le Monde in France, is they have a partial paywall, and under 40% of its content is paywalled and rest is free for access. So it's interesting. Only 40% is locked. The Telegraph has similar kind of model also. They have put things like rugby and business and politics behind a paywall. Most recently, the digital website, the Quartz, they also put up the partial paywall. So we have seen a lot of these kind of freemium models coming up. And the paywalls are quite prevalent in the UK, US, Scandinavia, and in France. Keeping up the paywall is also very costly. And we have seen in the case of the New York Times, for example, that their marketing budget has ballooned because they have to keep these people coming back to them and renew their payment. So a lot of people take that offer, for example, for a couple of months, and then the challenge there is to get them actually subscribing again.
And Alex, one of the things I remember when you embarked upon the research that led to the foundation of Press Patron was that people who indicated they would be prepared to pay for online news also wanted overseas content. They wanted bundled up with other stuff. Now, the New Zealand Herald has done this. There is four overseas suppliers who operate paywalls in their own territories, I guess, who are giving them the content that the Herald can host. Is that a smart move?
So it's definitely a good approach. It's good that they're including that broader range of journalism from a lot of different providers. But I think in the survey, the real desire was unlimited access and actually being able to visit the other websites without restrictions.
Oh, so they didn't want to have to get it, the New York Times via the Herald, for example.
Exactly. I'm sure readers will appreciate it, but it's very different getting a hand-curated selection of stories within one particular website versus having unlimited access to a range of different sites globally.
And Maria, is that what other companies in, say, Europe, particularly the ones you've looked at, have done?
It's not very common. And academic studies, for example, has found that the newspapers actually paywall at premium content, but then the syndicated content or the content which comes from newswires, the people can access that for free.
So I guess, Mary, subscriber retention is really the key. Do we find that once people have made a commitment, yes, I will subscribe, I'm prepared to pay for online news, are they as loyal as those printed newspaper buyers and subscribers tend to be?
Yeah, that's a good question and a big question, of course. In some cases, you start to see when you have a strong brand like the New York Times, people continue to subscribe. And then the people take up that offer and get them to subscribe for the longer term is a challenge. And remember that Herald is also offering now 2 months free access, discounted access. And then what happens after that? If people just try for a couple of months, will they subscribe? And that is the question we all wanted to know the answer.
Do you suspect that people will be, New Zealand readers will be accosted with lots of offers and future discounts and different mixes of the kind of plan they've come up with so far?
People take those offers and then they wait the next offer and they, you know, leave by the offers. So they don't want to subscribe for like for annual subscription. And that's the whole monetary challenge there for the news companies. Mm. And how do you actually keep those people paying in the longer term?
Coming back to the first point around the discounted offers, that's a very common approach when you have a paywall because there are other people typically can't afford the really high price that is placed on it. So around the world you see that and people sign up, and sometimes you get cancellation rates of up to 40, 50, 60% after 3 to 6 months. That's a lot of people being lost.
And you can't build a business model around that, or if you've...
You have to remarket and then try and get them back on board. But what we've found with the voluntary model is retention is incredibly high, because people have voluntarily opted into a price point that matches their budget. And after 12 months, you might still have 85 to 90% of your monthly subscribers from a year ago.
How important is that, that the money they pay really is going to directly channel into better journalism?
Yes, and a lot of companies like New York Times and the Washington Post, for example, they have hired a lot of journalists. And if you see that, you know, the companies are investing in journalism and they hiring the journalist, and they really give the journalist the space to do investigative reporting, as Alex correctly said, that they are great investigative reporters in the Herald. So if the people see that that is the money goes to enabling them to do that kind of journalism, I think, you know, that's where the value proposition comes, and then you're willing to pay for that brand if you see that it is the journalism which is supported by your money.
Yeah, and she did say she would hold the chief executive to that, and we will be following up on that too.
What they need to be careful, though, I think, and this was this morning, I just scammed quickly through what was the premium content, and they had the story, for example, about the Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. And if they keep continuing to put that kind of content behind the premium label, I think that's a dangerous way to do it.
That was Dr. Maria Mililati, co-director of the Centre for Journalism, Media and Democracy at the Auckland University of Technology. And we also heard there from Alex Clark, the chief executive and founder of Press Patron. And you can hear more of what they had to say about all this in the online version of the story on the Media Watch page of the RNZ website or the RNZ app. Or you can download it from our podcast feed. Just look for the title, Tapping the Readers for Revenue. Last Friday was World Press Freedom Day, and on 9 to noon this week, media commentator Gavin Ellis had some good news about where we had placed on the World Press Freedom Index, put together each year by the global media freedom group Reporters Without Borders.
To the World Press Freedom, which has
We've come up a notch. All right. We've come up a notch. We're now ranking 7. We were 8 last year. Our score has dropped by 2.87. Now, the lowest score is best. The lowest in the world is Norway at 7.82. The highest is Turkmenistan at 85.44, followed closely by North Korea at 83.4.
Well, good to know that we're nearer to Norway at the top and not the cellar dwellers North Korea, where the government controls the media absolutely. But in the months ahead, our media here could come into conflict with the powers that be when getting to the bottom of the Christchurch mosque attacks. And this week, one outfit already has.
How is it that a major news media organisation has managed to get its hands on New Zealand's updated terror watch list? These 100 individuals that our security agencies are supposedly keeping a vigilant eye on. How the hell did such a top-secret list end up in the hands of the news media?
Mike Yardley there on News Talk ZB, spluttering over a scoop in the Sunday Star Times last weekend under the headline, Secret Watch List Revealed. The paper said that more than 100 people are being actively monitored by police, but the police would not even comment on the list's existence, and they've since launched an investigation into just how that list ended up in the paper's hands in the first place. So, who is on that list? Well, the Sunday Star Times publisher Stuff said it chose not to name anyone on it or to contact anyone for security reasons. Now, that's not the first tough call the media here have had to make in a new environment after the Christchurch mosque attacks, and it won't be the last. There's going to be a royal commission investigating whether the attacks could have been prevented, how our security services monitor extremists, and whether they chose the right targets. The investigation is bound to uncover things that the government, the police, and our security agencies might want to conceal, withhold, or at least manage. Meanwhile, investigations by the media, which are just as hungry for answers, could come into conflict with the powers that be, who will reckon that they have national security on their side. In 2017, for example, an overhaul of spy agencies' powers created a new offence for people who pass on classified information. While the changes make it easier for people to make a protected disclosure to the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, those who pass information on to journalists might face up to 5 years in jail. Now, this law has yet to be tested, but it would be a brave member of the intelligence services who leaked anything to the media on that basis. New Zealand's search and surveillance laws have also been beefed up in recent years too, as Nikki Haga discovered in the wake of dirty politics. And the current government is also now exploring whether the law and procedures to protect whistleblowers at work need to be strengthened. In Australia, state governments already support whistleblowers who contact journalists there, but here there are no such so-called shield laws. The mosque attacks in Christchurch have also prompted some pretty unprecedented censorship. The chief censor swiftly banned the gunman's video and his so-called manifesto, and major internet service providers clubbed together to block websites that were hosting them. And if that was unprecedented, so was their acquiescence when the government then asked them to extend that block. On News Hub Nation last weekend, the broadcasting minister, Chris Farfoy, praised them for that.
Some of our internet service providers did shut down some sites that were propagating some of the material that happened as a result of March the 15th.
That's the industry regulating itself. That's not the government stepping in.
No, but I think if you look at the way the industry and the government worked in a lot of spaces, actually, and around the 15th, to make sure that New Zealanders were kept safe, it's quite promising.
On top of all this, there's also concern that revised hate speech laws could cramp the media's freedom of expression. And earlier this month, MP Louisa Wall raised eyebrows on Facebook by saying it was time that the media was recognised as part of the political system.
This would impose a duty of care on the media, requiring adherence to a standard of reasonable care while performing any acts that could foreseeably harm others.
Now, the mutual interests of our news media when it comes to their basic freedoms are represented by the New Zealand Media Freedom Committee, which this week agreed a set of common principles for covering the upcoming trial of Brenton Tarrant. The Media Freedom Committee's current chair is the New Zealand Herald's Mirianne Alexander, who we heard from earlier on Media Watch.
Look, I'm not concerned about clashes, but I think that it's really important that everyone sticks to their knitting, if you like. We will certainly, as the media, be doing our job. We've been faced, haven't we, with an unspeakable tragedy, and that we're in uncharted waters in terms of dealing with the aftermath. But I think we've all, as you alluded to, we've put out some protocols this week. We're all very much together as an industry on the fact that we've got an important job to do as we continue to cover the aftermath of Christchurch. Been having discussions, of course, about the fact that we should be making sure that we're vigilant about various aspects to the court case. We want to ensure that we're given a fair hearing there when it's when matters of suppression and things are considered. Same with the Commission of Inquiry. We're going to be very interested in how that unfolds, but I can assure you we won't be lying down on this. We'll be definitely watching to ensure that we can be the public's eyes and ears on these really important matters.
There are heavy penalties now, or heavier penalties, for people who leaked sensitive or classified information to the media. I mean, if it should come to that, that someone wants to leak something to the media and there's a threat to them or even to the journalist that might report it, is this something that the Media Freedom Committee, on behalf of all media, would be prepared to take on?
Oh, absolutely, because we must leave the media free to do the jobs that they should do, and we've got a duty to protect sources, but also to tell stories that are utterly in the public interest. So we'll be certainly watching closely for that.
I mean, so far, have you sensed anything or heard from any other journalists or editors that avenues of information that ought to be open are being closed down, or any pressure coming on any journalist who might know something about Christchurch, you know, such as that Stuff watch list story, which obviously the police weren't happy about, but no sense that anyone's being leaned on in any way so far?
We haven't been made aware of anything, but I do think that we are, as I said before, in uncharted territory, and people are sensitive to the fact that we have had this awful tragedy and we will be watching. It's one thing for the police to be unhappy about a leaking of information, and that wouldn't be the first time, would it? But we've still got a job to do, and we'll make sure that we do it.
We have seen some unprecedented sort of censorship, the chief censor's decisions. We've seen the internet service providers lock off access to websites, things that wouldn't normally happen. Louisa Wall, MP, writing a Facebook post that confused and alarmed some people, seeming to say that we need the media not to do harm and that they need to realise they're part of the political system. There might be a growing mood for a bit more censorship or restriction on the media, and if we end up debating hate speech laws, that there could be a kind of political mood among, you know, lawmakers and MPs that the media needs to be chopped back a bit?
I think that that was just a silly one-off, frankly, and I'd be very surprised if any mood emerged to curb the media's right to do its job, which is a fundamental part of our democracy.
And certainly they wouldn't.
And look, that was a really unusual thing, wasn't it? We're talking about a gunman live streaming a massacre. I mean, that is not something that happens every day. That is not something that New Zealand media companies would certainly do. So it is about the fact that they were doing that in an attempt to try and stop that spread of that incredibly awful and hateful video.
That was the current chair of the New Zealand Media Freedom Committee, Mirjana Alexander, who's also the New Zealand Herald's editor of premium content. Now, you can hear more about the media freedom issues arising in the wake of the mosque attacks in Christchurch in a special Media Watch article on the RNZ website. Just look for the title, Uncharted Waters for New Zealand Media Freedom. And finally on Media Watch this weekend, how political news turned to slush this past week. In this week's Listener magazine, there's yet another column by a pundit about the conundrum facing the National Party's leader now that the government has taken capital gains tax off the table. The author of the piece was Bill Ralston, formerly a political journalist but now a PR man and a media trainer for hire for politicians, among others. And Bill Ralston's main point was this.
Now Bridges has to find another issue on which to fight. There aren't a lot around at the moment, so he needs to find some killer propositions fast.
And last Sunday, Simon Bridges did seize on an issue which certainly gripped the media.
Should Corrections have spent over $1 million on 193 ice slushy machines at prisons across the country? The iced drinks were supposed to cool down prison staff during the long, hot summer, and Corrections Minister Kelvin Davis has backed the idea.
But how did that story emerge in the first place? Well, the National Party uncovered it with an Official Information Act request and then spoon-fed the slushy story to the media in a press release headlined Corrections $1 Million Slushy Fund. And having written the headline, the party's PR machine then wrote the top line for them too.
Information released under the Official Information Act shows Corrections spent $1.1 million on 193 ice slushy machines at the end of last year for staff to enjoy flavoured frozen beverages at work.
The National Party leader went on to say this.
I would not be at all surprised if it's prisoners as well who are getting their lips around these slushies.
That whole story was released by the National Party and posted on Facebook at 8 a.m. on the dot last Sunday. And it worked. News Talk ZB's news an hour earlier began like this.
At least five people are dead and thousands displaced after a second cyclone in less than 2 months has clobbered Mozambique.
But an hour later, this was how ZB's news began.
Taxpayers have forked out more than $1 million on frozen slushy machines in prisons.
And when Corrections responded soon after, poor old Mozambique was blown out of the bulletins altogether.
Chief Custodial Officer Neil Beals says the move was to support the safety and well-being of Corrections staff. He says the slushy machines were a one-off purchase and will be available for use for many summers to come.
Later in the afternoon, ZB's Weekend Collective show seized on the slushy story for its politics hour.
We're going to have Corrections Minister Kelvin Davis on.
$1.1 million on slushies.
News Hub at 6 went beyond the press release and spoke to an actual serving prison officer.
Simon Bridges is welcome to go put on the 8-kilogram vest and try and walk around in the prison with about 60 prisoners in the unit. See how he feels after, 8 days in a row doing that.
But the problem with talking to talkback callers, the leader of the opposition, the minister, and even prison officers' representatives was that none of them actually had a hand in the expensive order of the machines. But meanwhile, back on News Talk ZB, the slushy story kept on rolling. Overnight, talkback hummed with worries about the nutritional impact of slushies on tap.
I think they're killing them with kindness because it's sugary crap.
No, but anyone like my husband, for example, with diabetes, they wouldn't be able to have it.
And as Monday dawned, the slushy issue hung heavy over ZB's husband and wife, Morning Stars.
News, business and politics with substance. It's Early Edition with Kate Hawksby.
5 to 6, Mike Hosking. I'm sorry I don't have a slushy set to go for you here in the studio, but our budget didn't extend to the $5,000.
It's amazing. So if you set the precedent, I'm surprised the story isn't bigger this morning. If you set the precedent.
But Kate Hawksby and Mike Hosking, ZB colleagues, had done all they could to make it as big a story as possible.
This is a petty piece of political clickbait. He's just finished a whole lot of regional conferences, Simon Bridges. He's been demanding loyalty. His people have been demanding leadership. Slashies? Slashies?
Now, that was a good point there from Andrew Dickens. News Talk ZB's Barry Soper had actually gone to that party conference in Hamilton.
Here's the party wanting to get down to policy. Nice. Talk more about policy. What do they come out and do slushy machines being in bloody prisons around the country? I mean, if that's heavy policy, I don't know what it is.
And radio listeners might have wanted to hear about that policy too from the regional conference in Hamilton, the first of four, incidentally, around the country coming up. But on News Talk ZB, policy was drowned out by slushy talk. Meanwhile, RNZ's checkpoint was a slushy-free zone on Monday, but at rival talk station Magic Talk, the drive host Ryan Bridge was worried about how loud the machines are, how much power they use, and even their tax status.
The Inland Revenue so far has not responded to us. But give us a bell, 0800 844 747. Slushy machines, tax deductible or not?
Well, not was the simple answer to that. Now, back on News Talk ZB, Mike Yardley still wasn't done with the issue. He summoned into the chat slot the huddle, Bill Ralston, the PR man and lobbyist who'd urged Simon Bridges to find a new issue to pursue in the media.
Simon should be concentrating on the big issues.
A fair point there from Bill Ralston, but so was this one from Mike Yardley.
Although he didn't really get much traction on those high-minded policy pursuits like bracket creep, Bill, did he? So he had to go for the slushy machine.
Well, I think that's just going down too low. I think they're pitching him wrong.
And as if to make that point, party policy was discussed at the regional National Party conference in Hamilton last weekend and even voted on by party members. But that was only reported on in any detail to subscribers of the politic.co.nz website on Monday morning. On News Hub at 6 on Monday night, political editor Tova O'Brien was back talking up Simon Bridges' slushy woes like this.
But a lot of MPs have told us they're unimpressed with the way he handled Slushygate, which was Simon Bridges having a crack at corrections staff, corrections for spending $1 million on ice machines for overheated prison staff. Some of them, there's kind of a sense that that was petty and stupid and it was a welfare issue. And some of those MPs actually went on the record anonymously with us and told us that it didn't feel like a guy focused on being PM. That was a weird one. Why are we talking about slushies?
It was indeed a weird one. And something also for the news media to ponder. Why were they talking so much about slushies for nearly two whole days? As the National Party itself broke the story in the first place, pundits were comparing so-called Slushygate with David Shearer waving dead fish at Parliament and Don Brash walking a plank back in 2006. So what did all these instances really have in common? Well, they were all political stunts arranged for the media's benefit and then declared to be gaffes by political journalists. Well, that's all we have for you in Media Watch this weekend, but we'll be back again at about 10:30 next Wednesday night with Midweek Media Watch, talking to Karen Hay on The Lately Show, and then back again at the same time next Sunday for Media Watch here on RNZ National.